Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Ah, lovely drink of coffee there.
Perfectly timed. Yep. We've been sitting here, you had all this time, and you waited for me to go to you to speak to have some coffee. What a professional you are.
I needed some coffee.
You can be confused for a lot of things, but unprofessional is certainly not one of them. What a show we have coming up for you. The January camp is in the books. We're going to talk about that in mere moments. But really, the bulk of the talking is going to be done by the man who I oftentimes refer to now as the voice of American soccer, John Strong, who will join
us.
Would you disagree?
No, I wouldn't, but
I can't tell if you're... I think you've insulted.
I'm worried that we've had John Strong on several times.
Yeah.
Once from the back of a car with Fernando Fiore in the car.
Yeah.
And I think you've always introduced him in that fashion. And it's beginning to cloy. I don't like it.
Oh. I don't know what to say about this.
Change it up.
No. I might have, but now I can't. Let's see. Also, things are happening in MLS, and we kind of scratched the surface last week with Miguel Almiron, but I think we need to talk a little bit more about that in depth, so we will. A big mailbag, a glorious red card and man of the match. I can't wait for all of it, but we're going to start, like I said, with this.
America is back!
Oh, they sure are. A nice 2-0 victory over Costa Rica to close out January camp. Greg Berhalter in the books with a nice couple of wins to set us on the right course, JJ.
Sure. It's a great start for Berhalter. Two wins. I think it's been great for him to have a month, not quite a month, but a lot of the month of January with these new players, hit the ground running, get things started. But there's nothing to be read from the games. These have been...
Well, I won't go quite as far as you when I say there's nothing to be read.
Nothing. No, not a thing. Not a thing.
Well, that's... Not a thing. That's not true.
Well, it is. I've read things into it because you asked me to. But in general, I would say that it's been... The most important thing for me is that what Berhalter has talked about in terms of how he wants to set the team up, in terms of how he wants the team to play, he has got that transmitted. And I have a few things to say about the camp as well, which have really impressed me.
Okay.
Will I say them now? Do you want me to talk about them now?
I guess first I'll say the things that stood out to me.
Oh, okay.
Even though apparently nothing was to be taken of anything that has happened over the... look, I would say that, you know, people say that these are all C-team players, that, you know, what's the point?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, no.
But it's not like...
That's not strictly true.
Some of these guys are going to play in games that matter. Like, you're never going to have... When was the last time the U.S. went into any match of any significance with a fully healthy roster?
Absolutely.
Where every member of the first 11 was ready to go. So some of those players are going to have an impact in games of consequence. I thought that what we saw from Sebastian Lletget was really, really encouraging because he looked good before his injury, and I felt terrible for him when he was in good form and he suffered that injury, and it seemed like he was going to fall out of the national team picture, and he's gotten another chance to come back in. And what more could he do? Comes on as a sub, sets up a goal, scores a goal. I thought that was a really, I don't know what it's going to lead to, but I thought it was a really uplifting moment for him personally. And I think that's a positive sign that whatever you saw from him before his injury that you might have thought, oh, that's a shame, that's all going to go by the wayside now. Well, no, he appears to be back. I think he's going to be a really legitimate, solid contributor for this team moving forward. And, you know, if you want to talk about other things we saw, I would go back to the first game and say that what you saw from Michael Bradley to me indicates that he is going to be a part of this team and potentially a member of the starting 11 come Gold Cup time. So I think...
Well, look, if you accept that the U.S. men's national team will always be a mix of the best players playing in Europe and MLS players, then, of course, there are some names who have come to the fore. I think, for example, Nick Lima has had a great two games. Mihailovic again impressed me. I like him. I like his running. I think he's got a lot of potential. The partnership, for example, of Long and Zimmerman, that's a position where we seem to pick up injuries or have losses of form regularly. Mm-hmm. And Long and Zimmerman have a partnership. I loved Areola's finish, and I thought it was a great through ball by Sebastian Lletget. But I'm so conscious of the status of the players we were playing against.
Of course.
And you have to bear it in mind. I keep saying, though, it's not about that. It's what's been done off the field that has really impressed me.
And what is that?
Basically, the US men's national team, their social media people have done videos. And one of the videos they did for YouTube was just the first training session, the first few training sessions under Berhalter. Andrew, the level of detail and attention to detail really impressed me. And you could see that there is a certain style of play and a organizational quality that he's already brought. And you can tell it from this bit of audio.
Right, really important. We win the ball, we make the field big. If a teammate has time on the ball, you can stay away. If he's pressured, come to and support him.
Greg and the staff have been very detail-oriented. Before we start each session, they lay out a set of principles that they want to achieve in that session. We're able to rely on these principles, so that way when the game gets hectic, we have something to fall back on.
You can tell we are hungry. We want to soak up the information and try to implement the system.
You guys ready? Let's do it, huh?
The whiteboard, that's actually where he has the principles laid out for us. This is what we're going to do in the session.
Now, that may seem very basic and you'd be like, oh, well, there's a whiteboard and the session, the objectives of the session are there. But international football, and particularly when they get together for camps, can be really higgledy-piggledy. And it's not together. And there isn't an organisational structure. And there isn't a plan for every session. I've learned that from under Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane in the Republic of Ireland. And I honestly feel that level of detail was not there under Jurgen Klinsmann and was not there under Bruce Arena. And it's really good to see a manager come in with a defined style of play and a plan and a way of implementing that for the players.
It's very early, like we've reiterated time and time again. I actually like him so far. Like, you're right, there's not a ton that we can really go off of to come to any kind of judgment on the manager that he's going to be for the U.S. But I don't know, there's something about, like, he's very clear in kind of relaying the message of what it is that he wants to do. So if he's like that with the media, I have to believe that he's like that with the players as well, which I think we kind of just got a window into there.
Andrew, they did a drone shot, which is now very stylish in social media circles, yeah, of the training field. He has the training field set into quadrants like Bielsa or Guardiola would have. And that is because he's working on patterns of play. What's our shape without the ball? Well, actually, without the ball, Nick Lima is going to tuck into midfield. He's going to create a block there. We're going to get compact. When we have the ball, just like he said there in the audio, we're going to get wide and expansive. I never heard any of this from Klinsmann.
Yeah.
I never heard any of this from Bruce Arena.
Yeah.
So for me, from a coaching perspective, You've got to be positive and feel good about the message, if I can understand it, and I mean a dullard like you can.
No, it's American pea brain.
American pea brain over here.
Absolutely.
That's got to be good.
Well, JJ, let's continue this now, talking about Berhalter, talking about the team, and let's do so with one of our favorite people to speak with on these matters, Fox Sports' lead play-by-play soccer announcer, the voice of American soccer, as I refer to him, John Strong, back on the show right now. John, what's up, man? How are you?
Whether that is a good title or sends shivers down the back of your spine, that I'm the voice that defines all this nonsense. Thank you. I always enjoy coming on with you guys.
It's entitled to be proud of.
Well, we've had an argument over it, John. I said that Andrew introduces you that way every single time, and I thought maybe he could come up with a new moniker for you, and he hasn't even bothered.
No, I'm not clever or creative in any way, shape, or form. But, John, I want to talk about this. We're talking about this new era, I guess, that you'd have to say the U.S. men's national team is kind of embarking upon and kind of just wrapped up the initial go round of, obviously there's things in the game that we see on TV, but your access is different than that of guys like JJ, myself, and the fans. I mean, I'm curious, can you take us behind the curtain? Greg Berhalter, what's he like? What kind of differences do you see with him compared to maybe some of the previous U.S. managers? Take us inside if you can.
Well, I'll preface it by saying that I don't want any of these comments to be taken as a criticism of Jurgen Klinsmann or Bruce Arena or Dave Sarakin, who are the others that I've, as the national team coach, worked under, because, it's not necessarily about that. However, I've quite enjoyed actually sort of following Greg Berhalter's arc. We did a game with him pretty early in his tenure in Columbus. It was a Columbus at Kansas City game, and, we really only see him once a year because Columbus just don't end up on our Fox schedule very often. But every time we do, we have enjoyed an increasingly sort of cordial and respectful, really good relationship with him, partly as he's gotten to know us, and I think as he's become more comfortable with the media in general. He's one of those guys I actually have felt comfortable. I can ask a fairly direct question, and he's not going to get his feathers ruffled about it. And I also think it's something that he has really embraced, the idea that he needs to be the face of this thing. I think it was one of the things that really hurt U.S. soccer throughout this last year as all this stuff was going on and as people were shooting arrows at them from all angles, some of them absolutely deserved and some of them less so, there was no one to speak for U.S. soccer. You had a federation president, Carlos Cordero. It's not really his comfort zone to be out in front of the media. A general manager, Ernie Stewart, who started to at first, I think he felt really hard done by the way that some of his comments, some of the honesty he tried to give in a roundtable with reporters in September, I think he felt was used against him quite a bit in continuing criticism the rest of that month. And so he got to a point where he's like, all right, I'm done with you guys. So I think Greg Berhalter has understood and has embraced the idea that, as I said, he needs to be the face and the voice of this thing. And he's really done quite well. I've been impressed with his manner with media behind the scenes. We actually enjoyed a really neat session with him the afternoon before the Costa Rica game. He came to us and he said, can I sit you guys down for an hour and we do a big sort of video tactical session? And not only was it his idea, but as he started, he was almost a little embarrassed. He kind of said at one point, is this too much? Are you sure this is okay? I feel like I'm just giving you a big propaganda thing. We said, no, this is great. This is what we want. This is what we've been thirsting for a while, is a coach with the willingness and the ability to take us a little bit in depth. If for no other reason, then we can more fairly and accurately judge the product on the field because now we understand what you're telling the players and what you're showing them. And he took us in pretty good detail in video clips, as well as sort of with the whiteboard and the magnetic little pegs, trying to detail the system that he's putting in place. At the same time, and this is what I always respect out of people, is when they're honest about what they don't know. And that's something that Greg Berhalter has done. He's been very honest with himself, understanding it is a big transition, club management to international management. He talked to us about conversations he had had with managers that have international experience, the understanding that a lot of his system in Columbus just is not going to work in the international game. Among other things, he pointed to the idea of having his outside backs, basically his wingers, all the way up the field. He said, you just cannot do that at the international game where it's all about, as he put it, offensive transition, or you could also, I guess, call it counterattacking, and that teams are so good at that, you leave yourself way too exposed. And that was where this concept of, instead of using an outside back super high up the field as a winger, using an outside back as extra beef in the middle of the field, sort of that role we saw Nick Lima playing, that's kind of where that idea came from a little bit. And obviously, like a lot of younger coaches, he's watching film, he's watching tape and games from all over, and inevitably a lot of that's going to be Pep Guardiola picking that up. So I was impressed with the whole package. Clearly the players enjoyed it. They feel energized. Michael Bradley in particular, you could just see how much he enjoyed the process of those 3 weeks. And saying that, this is going to be a whole new challenge for him. Not coaching a team day in, day out, sitting on the sideline the next month or so, and then the process that he took MLS players through for 3 weeks, he's going to have European-based players with whom he doesn't have as much of a relationship, with whom he has not spent as much time up close, either coaching against or coaching for, and he's going to have 3 days instead of 3 weeks to onboard them onto his program and to put it out on the field against tougher opponents in March than we saw here. So I think you can simultaneously say that was just about as good a January camp as we could have hoped on all sides, while at the same time understanding we got a whole long ways to go.
John, you're a good man to ask this question of, and I think you'll be an honest broker. Which players from this camp, because we know it was an MLS camp, which ones that you saw in the two games do you feel have a genuine chance of breaking into that, we'll say, match day 22 and making a real impact, maybe coming on as a sub or maybe even starting in a Greg Berhalter 11 when it really matters in a competitive game?
Because that's a tough thing, isn't it? I mean, we have to understand what the January camp is and isn't. By the same token, and U.S. Soccer loves to put this out there, that just about every January camp for the last number of years has featured a player. At the time, no one would have, who thought in January of 2002 Pablo Mascherini was going to become impactful at the World Cup? Who thought at the time Matt Beisler was going to become a regular starting center back for the U.S.? There's always been guys that have come out of there. But it is tough. So I'll take as an example Nick Lima. Nick Lima is a fascinating young man, really impressive young man to speak to. He was of the players we talked to, the one we all went, okay, this kid's got something. He's intelligent. He's well-spoken. Really impressive stuff. Had a good camp. Was given the nod over Reggie Cannon at the right-back role. was pushed into some very uncomfortable positions by his own reckoning and honesty, and yet did okay there. And so you would, on the one hand, look at it and go, you know what, this kid's got the chance. Who on earth would have thought that DeAndre Yedlin, 6 months out of the January camp in 2014, would have been an impact sub at the World Cup? By the same token, I'm a big believer in sort of the Malcolm Gladwell, you know, 10,000 hours concepts for proficiency. And Lima is another one of these players who, you know, is starting his professional career at 22. Four-year player at Cal. He's in really his second full season as professional. You know, I was always told Robbie Earle was a big proponent of this concept, 100 matches as a professional before you really figure out what you're doing. Now, are you getting there at 21 and you're an academy product? Are you getting there at 25? So it is really hard to say because, as I said, you have all of these very good examples of players sort of surprising and coming out. But I will say Nick Lima left a good impression on Greg Berhalter. Georgi Mihailovic left a very good impression on Greg Berhalter, who describes him as elegant. I don't think I've ever heard him use that word in any other context. Someone's got to score goals for this team. Jozy Altidore, if he's fit, we know he can. It drops off pretty quick after that, and Jossie Zardes is getting opportunities, but he hasn't scored for almost 3 years. So is that a Christian Ramirez or who? And the other one I would say, as much as everyone looks at it and goes, okay, the center-back pairing, if the U.S. had a meaningful competitive match tomorrow, is John Brooks plus someone. Aaron Long and Walker Zimmerman both, easy to sort of discount them, brush them off to the side. These are MLS guys. They're really even sort of the lesser half in some ways, you could argue, of their center-back pairings over the last couple of years. And yet, in Greg Berhalter's setup, those center-backs are being left on an island. They're being asked to do a lot of 1v1 defending by themselves in certain situations. And Berhalter specifically praised the fact that both of those guys come from teams where that's what they're being asked to do all the time, the Red Bulls and LAFC. Not quite what some of the American center backs in Europe are being asked to do. So that's going to be part of it as well. It's all well and good to say, well, this guy's clearly at a higher level. He plays in a club in Europe. He's got international experience. Can he do what Greg Berhalter is asking him to do? Because I think that's something that Berhalter is saying. He's not going to be stupid, but he's also has a system in mind, and who can play together in that right system. And he's starting from scratch here, and that's an exciting process, but it might also be a little bit scary at times because you're going to get some players ending up in situations that, you know, we might see a Walker Zimmerman or an Aaron Long in a game where you're like, okay, can you guys handle it? And they're going to have to figure out if they can sink or swim.
John, one thing that I thought was interesting from this camp, there's not usually much controversy or anything like that that comes out of a January camp, and I'm not necessarily saying that that was the case here, but for a first-time manager, Greg Berhalter did have a couple things that he had to deal with. You know, Michael Bradley, the decision to not give him the captain's armband, and perhaps more so, Kellen Acosta and the decision to send him home. When Berhalter is making moves like this in his first camp, his first time with these players, should we not be looking too deeply into those two moves, or do you think he has to, you know, feels like he has to do something like that to kind of set a tone or send a message early on?
I think they're two separate situations. I would say with Kellen Acosta, and it's sort of a bummer because I remember that, you know, he started the game at Azteca in June of 2017. He started with that group at the Gold Cup, and we all thought, you know, here this kid comes. I mean, he's really into his moment. And then I think he was one of the players that was really strongly emotionally affected by missing the World Cup. And then he picks up the groin injury the following winter, ends up needing a change of scenery out of Dallas, and hopefully he can get back on track at Colorado. But it's a shame in some ways that he's fallen off as far as he has. But he kind of has fallen off, you know, and that's going to be his challenge is getting back up. As I said, from a place less than 2 years ago where we really thought, man, this guy's pounding on the door. I think, you know, listen, Michael Bradley is going to remain until he retires internationally the most polarizing figure on this national team, and I don't even think it's a close second. You can say what you want about Jozy Altidore and maybe some other guys, but, you know, what Michael sort of attracts to himself is pretty impressive. I'm interested to see. Now, not having him have the armband, not having him play at all against Costa Rica, I don't read a whole lot into that. I think it's Berhalter's mandate here to have a clean slate and to put a lot of players out there, and I think it behooves him to see, okay, can Will Trapp, as much as I know him, this is a different role I'm asking of him, how's he going to handle doing it? I also think it's not the worst thing in the world to put a little bit of a chip on Michael Bradley's shoulder. And understand what I mean here. You know, this is a guy that pretty much has been an automatic in his career, that when he is with the U.S., he's starting. Very rarely is he being left on the bench. Very rarely is he coming on as a sub. And in the minutes after the game ended against Costa Rica, you know, the players sort of filter back into the locker room and the game's over and all stuff. Almost immediately after that, Michael Bradley's back out on the field with a trainer, and he's doing strides from one 18 to the other. He's doing shuttle runs within the 18, getting the fitness work in. As I said, this is a guy that I think felt really energized by what Berhalter brought. I think the two of them really see the game and the preparation, the minutia in the same way. And Berhalter was honest with us. Michael Bradley did not have a very good 2018. That's not a very bold statement to say. I think we all know that. But I don't think there's anyone that's going to work harder every single day to try to get back to a good level than Michael Bradley. So I wouldn't read as much into it, but I also think there absolutely is a little bit of a fire lit under him right now by Greg Berhalter, and that's one that I'm going to be fascinated to see. Because I always remember a couple years ago, Jermaine Jones, and we were all saying, listen, Jermaine, you're old, the game has passed you by. And he said, okay, then one of these young kids can come take my spot, because he had that sort of competitive fire. I see Michael Bradley in the same way. Someone's going to have to take the spot from him, and it's not going to be because he's not going to be working himself to the bone every single day in training to try to keep that spot.
John, this is a little bit of a left field one for you, but it's about you yourself. And we're always talking about the change that needed to happen and that has happened in certain areas since that night in Trinidad in 2017. As a commentator, now that you're back in the saddle, it's a new era with Greg Berhalter, and you're doing that friendly. Have you changed anything about your commentary, about the way you approach this team, or maybe the message you put out about them since that night?
You know, it's an interesting question, because the temptation is to do that. And the temptation is to, I think we always want to match the tone that the viewer has at home. We don't want to lie to the viewer. We don't want to sell them something that isn't there. At the same token, it doesn't do us any good to come on the air for the Costa Rica game and be like, okay, this game doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. Next on Fox. You know, we got to sell these things too. So Yeah. There's a balance. But I don't subscribe, because this is just not how I work. I don't subscribe to the level of anger and cynicism and vitriol that has been put out there about the men's national team program. Part of it is it's not really my job to level those criticisms on air. My job is more as the reporter, and it's Stu, and it's Alexi, and it's Moedu, who's coming and got a couple games with us. It's more their job to provide the opinion. But I just, as easy it would be to hang on to the continued anger, and as many voices that are out there preaching that, some of whom because they didn't themselves get to be a part of a solution. And I think it behooves all of us as, you know, consumers of information to understand where is that information coming from and what biases might have taken on its way. I look at it more, okay, it still is a wound that is open that the U.S. missed the World Cup. And in fact, I probably annoy some people with the fact that I think I've referenced that every national team game I've done since the Trinidad loss, I've referenced missing the World Cup in one way or the other. So it's not that you're forgetting it, but also it is about looking forward, because you can't fix that now. And it is sort of an exciting process, I feel, to what it's going to become. And particularly with Greg Berhalter now, this is something that we talked about the night before at dinner. There is our, you know, what is American soccer? What's the American soccer style of play? What's the way forward for the men's national team? Greg Berhalter has as much influence as any other individual on the next 5 to 10 years of what American soccer looks like. If the men's national team can get back to its place of prominence as being sort of the tip of the spear of what soccer in America is, and it's a long ways from that. TV ratings show that. The ticket sales for these friendlies show that. That goes back, you know, more than a year. But if you can get back there, and if the men's national team gets back to that place of really setting the trend for how soccer is perceived in this country, Berhalter is going to have his fingerprints all over that. Everything from team selection to tactics and formations and styles to just, as I said, being the public face and the voice of the team. That's a pretty exciting concept. And that's something where I like that Berhalter was the pick because at the very least, whether you agree with the decisions that he makes, this is someone who cares deeply and passionately about the project. And that's, I think, the kind of coach that you really need to have. Someone who's going to wake up every single day and all they're thinking about and they're consumed with this gigantic challenge of, among other things, getting people excited again about this team. This is not a coach for whom it's a stepping stone to something else. This is not a coach for whom it's a vanity play, as it has been for others. This is the most important job Greg Berhalter has ever had in his life, and it's in his blood, as it is for Ernie Stewart as well. That's part of why I think Ernie was looking for a guy like that. So at the very least, it's an exciting project, and it's exciting to think about writing this history forward to hopefully we're all sitting there in Qatar in a couple of years, and it's sort of the culmination of that journey. But I think you can do that without necessarily lying to the viewer or casually forgetting the deep, deep crater that we're sort of trying to rise out from.
John, one more from me. And you're kind of talking about it a little bit with where this team is headed and excitement starting to kind of rebuild. We're seeing young players of real promise kind of showcasing their skills now in Europe. And I guess I'll just ask you this in the most broad way possible. You look at this team, is this a good team right now?
I don't think there's any possible answer for that. I hope it is. I really do. I've called too many men's national team games last couple of years where they're not a good team, and that's not been very fun. I've been in too many camps and in around the team too many times when it doesn't feel very excited. There's just something, you know, again, 2017 was a good example, or even some towards the end of the Jurgen era where it just, you could tell something wasn't quite right. And without being a revisionist historian, you can sort of connect some of the dots backwards to some of what happened after. So I'm hoping for brighter days. That's where the Gold Cup excites me, because you can only play the team that's in front of you. And that's going to be the next test. And we understand, by the same token, you know, not going too far with what we've seen in the January camp, it was less than 2 years ago. We were in that same stadium. We were staying in the same hotel. We were in the hotel bar after the U.S. had beat Honduras 6-0 in the World Cup qualifier. And we're all toasting the fact, okay, whatever happened against Mexico and Costa Rica, it's fine. We're going to make the World Cup. Everything's great again. And the U.S. won that Gold Cup. And we all thought, man alive, this Bruce Arena's got him clicking. And all it took was the loss to Costa Rica, and all of a sudden the wheel started falling off. So I think that's where, again, you contextualize it in the right way. You don't overstate it. But that's where this Gold Cup is exciting. It's going to be the first real test. Does Greg Berhalter actually have the answers? And is he the right man there? It's not going to be the final answer. Neither necessarily is qualifying for the World Cup. That was something Ernie Stewart told us in October when we sat down with him in Tampa. As he said, it's not even just qualifying, it's how do we play once we're there. But that's further off in the future. Even the March camp, I could see, this is pure speculation, but I could see him, rather than sort of mixing the January camp winners with the established core from Europe, I could see him wanting an entirely different group just to get his eyes on as many players as possible, sort of get hands-on. If that happens, then June in the Gold Cup is the first time when you get a sense of, who does Greg Berhalter think his best 11 and his best squad is? Can he manage a team to a win? And by the way, Gold Cups have gotten more difficult. And by the way, Mexico and Tata Martino have the target squarely on the U.S.'s back in that thing, too, particularly having missed out the last couple of Gold Cups. So that's where it's exciting to see what happens. But I don't think it's at all possible to have a real sense yet of, is this thing really truly on track? Do we really have the players? At the very least, there's a good feeling, and you were able to, at the very least, see that, you know, Berhalter is able to come up with some ideas, translate that to players, and that the players can then go and execute that on the field. And at the very least, there have been plenty of instances with the men's national team in recent years where that has not occurred. So that at least is in itself a step forward.
Yeah, I'm just, I'm just itching for an answer to that question because we've gone so long now with any like real gauge as to whether or not they're good. Like, we're watching these young players and it's been fun, but people keep saying, oh, they're rebuilding. Oh, who knows? This is, you know, like this January camp, this is just their C team. Like, I just can't tell what's real and what's not. And I just need some guidance and some help. But I guess I've come to the wrong place.
The one thing I will emphasize to you and the people listening to this, and this is something, this is true in any realm of life that I've come to understand in my brief time on this earth, relatively compared to others. The idea that we don't always know the answer, but no doesn't replace that, which is to say that exactly as you say, there are a lot of prominent voices out there. There are a lot of loud voices out there saying, no, it's no good. Exactly like you said, it's a C team, it doesn't mean anything, and there's a heap of negativity. They don't necessarily know for sure either, but they can get more traction by being negative, I would argue, than by being positive. Or as I said, some of those loud, prominent voices are motivated by the fact that they didn't get to be a part of this process, and so it's negatively coming out of as a result. Doesn't mean that they're going to be proven wrong long term. We don't know, but there's no way any of us can have a real answer yet, and it does not make for very good sports radio. I was a terrible sports talk radio host as a result, because I love to exist in that world of we don't know, we're going to have to play the game. But I would be very cautious of the persistently loud negative voices and believing them, because the fact of the matter is they don't really know for sure either.
John, are you implying that we live in a sports media landscape that is negative? This is shocking to me.
I'm implying we live in a landscape, period, that's negative. That's
yes. Yeah, you're right. That's a great point.
But it certainly manifests itself here that you know, people try to prop themselves up as having more knowledge than others because they tell us how stupid and wrong we all are. And that's the kind of thing where I go, okay, let's just... But as I said, we're desperate to know now, because none of us want to live through Trinidad away again, ever. And so we're desperate to get to a point where we feel confident it's not ever going to happen again. I just don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
There's too many known unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld once said.
It's the unknown unknowns that really get you. I love that quote. Politics aside, I actually love that quote and that concept, but yeah.
No, he was onto something, and we should apply it to U.S. soccer now going forward. And hey, at the end of a goal, at the end of a Gold Cup, we may still be in this Rumsfeldian nightmare where there are so many unknown knowns.
That is true. Well, John, you're always so generous with your time. We appreciate it greatly. Lead soccer voice at Fox Sports, John Strong. Thanks, man. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Great stuff, man. John Strong.
Such a nice man.
Yeah,
and
really is.
And thoughtful and genuine as well. It's very hard, and you know me, I pick holes in all the commentary teams. It's very hard to pick a hole with John Strong.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's
great. His call for the Real Madrid goal, the Bale goal, is featured on one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Second Captain's podcast.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the best.
Yeah, and they were the ones that gave me the idea for doing more music beds.
Ah, so that's where it came from.
Yep.
Hey, we're going to take a super quick break. We'll be right back with some thoughts on we're talking about landscapes changing. How about MLS's landscape?
Oh,
we'll
you're so
that.
Excited about this.
I haven't said anything. You don't know what excites me, all right? Mailbag, red cards, man of the match, all of that.
That was creepy.
And more. Don't go anywhere. Oh, back now. Caught offside. Oh, JJ, MLS. Unbelievable, the things that are happening in MLS right now.
Really?
Well, I think the transfer window in Major League Soccer was more interesting than the one in the Premier League.
Well, they kind of crossed over, didn't they?
Well, with Miguel Almiron.
Yeah.
Which we have spoken about. His move, a record-setting move for Newcastle, the most that they've ever spent, and it comes on a player coming from Atlanta United FC. But there is so much more to what has gone on than just Miguel Almiron, JJ.
By the way, can I just mention, Newcastle put out the video of his first training session, which was today. It was every bit the Santiago Muniz, windy, you know, just typical grey Newcastle day. They're all wrapped up. The North Sea is blowing in upon the training ground, and it reminded me of what could go wrong for him.
This spring, he's jet-lagged, nervous, he's never seen mud before.
Maybe he'd don't have the stamina for the English game.
Adios, amigo. I'll be better tomorrow, I promise.
There's not going to be a tomorrow, Santiago.
That's really bleak.
I know. He's got to be careful. He should probably call Santiago Munez and just chat with him about what went wrong. Also, if I see him dating Anna Friel, then we know it's all gone wrong.
You know, I've never been ashamed to say it. I'll say it right now for any new listeners to this podcast. It's a great movie. I love every second of it. And I recommend it to anyone who has even the most remote interest in this sport.
And now we're living it.
With Miguel Almiron.
By the way, they're all wrapped up. Like, they're all wrapped up at the Newcastle training ground. And Rafa just rocks out in a pair of shorts.
Good for him, man. He's great.
He's well insulated.
But, you know, we're talking about the Almiron move from Atlanta to Newcastle. And then you've got Alphonso Davies, who's gone to Bayern Munich from MLS and has immediately been placed on their Champions League roster. He's not even 20 yet. And then even beyond that, it wound up not coming to fruition, but Luciano Acosta appeared to have been headed to PSG, but that move fell through, it appears, at the last minute.
That's not good. I'll tell you, Wayne Rooney was sweating that deal out because essentially Wayne Rooney's legs were being transferred to the French League.
He called Luciano Acosta one of the best players he's ever played with.
Yeah. But if you look at when their partnership blossomed, Acosta did a lot of the things that Rooney can't do anymore. And you got to hope that he gets back to DC United. I saw a piece, I think it was by Stephen Goff in the Washington Post, just saying he's got to focus now and not be disappointed. Please focus on the new season, because the last thing that they want is an unhappy player, because I'm sure he's thinking about the money he could have made.
Yeah, probably. But he is going back to DC United. And this all of these things happening, these players now going, you know, even though Acosta didn't, but you know, these players now going from MLS directly to prominent moves to major European leagues. I think it puts American soccer fans in an awkward place because, you know, obviously Atlanta fans don't want to see Miguel Almiron leave their club. But JJ, I just can't help but think of the credibility that it adds to this league on a global scale. And you know, I hate to be blunt in saying this, but that is something that I think MLS has lacked, quite frankly. I think people, for whatever reason, it's always been a gut reaction, I think, outside of the U.S. and even inside of the U.S. I don't want to leave out American fans. The gut reaction oftentimes with MLS is to mock it. And I think the more you see guys like Almiron, like Acosta, if he does eventually leave for some big-time move, like Davies, you know, these things are going to keep happening. I think the floodgates are now open. The threshold's been crossed. Now, the more you see these guys go abroad and play prominent roles with new clubs, it's going to bring credibility to this league.
I think the league is a platform now. The credibility comes from the perception has changed a little bit. It was always seen as basically Ashley Cole, his comments were the template.
Right.
Where I don't really fancy going to retire on a beach somewhere. Before his move to Roma, where he promptly spent quite a lot of time on a bench and then decided to sign for the LA Galaxy. But that was the perception of the league. And some of the moves that you've seen mooted in the last few years, like Fernando Torres last offseason, talk about him going to Chicago Fire. And you straight away thought, retirement league. Even Schweinsteiger, retirement league. But now you see it more as, or certainly South American players are going to see it more as, here's a platform for us to get noticed, because MLS is more visible now in England and in Europe than I would say many of the South American leagues. And it makes scouting, except for Danny Mills and people, it makes scouting a lot easier to have. I wouldn't say Almiron hasn't kicked a ball from Newcastle, so there will be still some skepticism on Tyneside about him. But the point is that MLS is now a good halfway house for players who want to go, good quality South American players who want to go to Europe. And thus, that will raise the level of the league for however long those players are there.
Definitely. And, you know, I swear I'm not pandering when I say this, but I really do give a lot of credit to American soccer fans, MLS fans in particular, of the clubs in this league. Because I think that there was this perception from the league before they kind of changed gears and went in the direction that they went to, where if we didn't have a David Beckham, nobody would show up. You know, if there wasn't a Steven Gerrard, no one would watch. Frank Lampard, Thierry Henry. And I think American soccer fans proved that idea wrong and said, look, okay, like, it's great. Will that guy help us win? Well, no. Okay, well, then I don't care. Like Atlanta United FC.
But Darren Eales decided that that's not the way they were going
right.
to go.
And look what they did. They packed that place with 70,000 plus in a town that people thought wasn't a pro sports town. They put players on that team like Almirón, like Joseph Martinez, who were not names. People didn't know
No.
I mean, Almirón maybe a little bit more so, but by and large, people didn't. American soccer fans didn't know who these guys were.
But you
because
think,
they were good, soccer fans in this country recognized it. The team was winning. And that's what puts butts in seats and eyeballs on televisions. Winning. It doesn't need to be the big splashy name, the veteran player who comes back for one last paycheck and a nice quiet send-off into the United States of America. People want to see their teams win.
It's easier to make a young talent who's going to be around for a while trying to prove himself into a club legend than it is to get over Steven Gerrard and try and do what they did at the LA Galaxy. The Robbie Keanes and the David Villas, they are kind of few and far between. MLS is learning that slowly. It's been a long process. But Robbie Keane is a legend for the Galaxy because of his competitive nature, and he will never change. Even if he plays five-a-side now, he'll always be the same. Steven Gerrard wasn't that way. Steven Gerrard was done and really didn't do his research into what the league was, and it really very much was a kind of resting place for him. It wasn't this exciting new challenge. But if you said to someone like Pity Martinez, I can put you in front of 70,000 people, or we'll say 55,000 minimum, week in, week out at home, and it's also a really good staging spot for you to further your career, why would they not do it? I would say now MLS is going to be more visible to the kind of clubs in Europe that are looking to bring in talent from South America than we'll say the Argentinian League is or the Brazilian League. That's TV.
I don't know if we're there quite yet. I think that you're making a little bit of a leap in saying that, but I think that like, that path is now
I'm
being
not saying
carved.
That it's a better league. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the platform is there. Don't forget, you can watch MLS in England now.
No, absolutely.
That's got, you know, that sounds like a small thing, but it does raise awareness of the league more.
But you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned Pity Martinez, because he's the perfect example. Almirón leaves, and like for all the fans who are upset and disappointed, you know, that MLS maybe is turning into a seller's league, but like, Almirón going from MLS to that league shows other players, prominent players in South America, like, no, come here. This is a springboard to bigger things.
By the way, I think
it's good.
I'm now fascinated to see how Almirón will adjust to the league.
Oh, yeah.
Adjust to life in Newcastle. Imagine, you're going, he has swapped a great fan base for possibly one of the most obsessive goldfish bowl fan bases in world soccer. He has swapped that, and he's not going to have the adulation anymore. It's not going to be taken for granted that he's a legend. He has to come in and prove himself all over again in a relegation battle.
Yeah, boy, between him being there and between Yedlin being there, like, I really hope they don't go down. I want them to stay in the Premier League. I really do.
I don't know. I feel as if I would like to see new ownership there, and I don't know if Ashley has relegated them twice since he's taken ownership of the club.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And I think a third time might finally get rid of him, and that's what Newcastle fans would like.
By the way, we're talking about MLS transfers, and we haven't even mentioned maybe the most prominent one, not financially, but in name, and that is Sebastian Giovinco, who is no longer a member of Toronto FC. He goes to Al Hilal in Saudi Arabia on a transfer fee that was, to me, surprisingly small. I think it's somewhere between the $2 to $3 million range.
But he's 32 now.
That's true.
And
but he's going to a country where
his wages will be massive there.
Yeah.
So that'll be factored into it as well. And look, Toronto played that one perfectly. He is now getting kind of injured on a regular basis. They got the best years out of his career.
God, was he good.
He was very, very good.
My God, was he good.
Free kicks outside the box with him in MLS was almost like a penalty. You knew he was going to hit the target or put it in the net. One or the other.
Ball at his feet. He was sensational. It was like it stuck to him.
I think he's going to look at his career. He's going to be delighted with the win, MLS Cup and that. But I always looked at him and thought, you could still play in Europe. You could still be in your national team. And I wonder now, with a move to Saudi Arabia at 32, is he going to have a little bit of regret that he stayed quite as long as he did in Toronto? Or that he moved at all.
I think he wanted to stay in Toronto. I think he started expressing discontent with his contract situation last season,
yeah.
And it clearly never got worked out. Obviously, the question that's being asked in the wake of him leaving, is he the greatest designated player, international designated player signing of all time? Taylor Twellman weighed in on that.
I think he's in the conversation. I mean, you just look at the numbers. 68 goals, 52 assists in four seasons. Numbers say one thing. The team won. He won a ton of trophies. I'm still impartial to Robbie Keane, though, Seb. I saw what Robbie Keane did from opening coming in. And yes, he had Landon Donovan and David Beckham. But you also look at Giovinco. He had the Michael Bradleys and Jozy Altidores and a team that spent $9 million more than any other team in Major League Soccer. So I'm not going to say Toronto didn't have the tools around Giovinco. I think he's in the conversation unequivocally. But if you're asking me, which you are, I'm looking at Robbie Keane. I still think Robbie Keane is the best designated player internationally that we've seen in MLS history.
I actually have nothing to add to that. That's exactly how I feel about this.
Yeah, I would say that. For me, it's Keane because he won more. Simple as that.
And he scored more.
He won more. He scored more.
Yeah. Toronto will certainly miss him. That goes without saying. They did bring in Terrence Boyd. But I saw Jeff Carlisle, I was glad, pointed out on Twitter for people almost refer. It's not a like-for-like change.
Of course. How could it? They're not the same player at all.
No, not at all. Now, it's good to add a player of that caliber.
Terrence Boyd is more in the mold of a Jozy Altidore, which makes me wonder, is Jozy now going to move on?
Yeah, what are they? I mean, Jozy has already, he's almost already started talking about Toronto, in a past tense.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting.
Yeah. So very interesting stuff. MLS is getting closer. It's the longest season, and we're almost ready for the start of it. So
crazy.
We will, of course, talk more about it as we get closer. Mailbag in just a sec, but, JJ, hiring. Hiring can be pretty time-consuming. You post a job to several online job boards only to get tons of the wrong resumes. Then you have to sort through all of those resumes just to find a few people with the right skills and experience. Those job sites that overwhelm you with the wrong resumes, they're not smart. That's why you should do the smart thing and go to ZipRecruiter.com/offside. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience and actively invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates and you get them fast. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, listeners to this podcast can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/offside. If you love this show, show your support to it and ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/offside, OFFSIDE. That's ZipRecruiter.com/offside. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Yes. JJ, you have a big mailbag in front of you, don't you?
At CO Soccer Pod, CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. You can also contact us via Instagram. CaughtOffside ESPN is our Instagram. A lot of people have started following us now, so please continue to follow us and make it worthwhile. We'll start putting more stuff up there. Johnny Boy Soprano kicks us off. What about Tim Weah? Another goal. This was a very good team move. Tim Weah on the end of it for Celtic versus Kilmarnock at the weekend.
McGregor, Sinclair and Weah are there. It's Weah! And he continues his habit of scoring as a super sub. And that is job done by Celtic.
And he played again, I believe, today versus Hibernian. He didn't score, but he started. So this is working out pretty much as we expected.
I think that's selling what he's doing a little bit short. We hoped that he would go there and contribute, but I mean, he didn't today. But JJ, it feels like he's coming in as a sub and scoring every game.
That goal was against St. Johnston, by the way, not Kilmarnock.
His runs have been great. His finishing has been great. He set up. He came on as a sub. Not only did he score, he also assisted on one before that. This is going exceedingly well.
And we forget how young he is as well.
When do we start to wonder about, we're talking with John Strong before about U.S. who's on this first team. It feels like jobs are up for grabs. You know, I know he's young, but like he might be in my first 11 right now.
Sure. And he was in Dave Sarakin's regularly when he tried to put out the strongest team he could in those games against Colombia, etc.
I love what he brings. Is he fast? And I think the thing that we sometimes worried about maybe with him, first touch, finishing ability. Well, so far he's passing every grade playing for Celtic in the Scottish Premier League, which say what you want about the competition.
This is good for him.
This is great.
Yep, definitely. Kevin Stiles. Love the pod. Medium time listener. What would you say medium time was?
Six months? We started in April of 2014, so I would say that probably means, like, I don't know, early 2018, late 17, maybe, after the U.S. elimination, all that.
I had a question, mostly for JJ, about something that always bothered me about British football. Perhaps it's my American brain, but how is it that Birmingham, second largest metropolitan area and third most affluent city behind Manchester and London, never seems to be able to field a consistently elite team like Manchester and London? With money being what it is and no salary cap to create some artificial form of parity, it seems strange to me that, other than Saunders' run in the 1970s, I'm presuming you're talking about Ron Saunders, no one from Birmingham has been consistently challenging for titles in a half century. Well, the two Birmingham sides were founder members of the Football League. And to be fair, Aston Villa had 7 league titles, equal to the amount Manchester United had before Fergie won his first for the club's 8th, in 1992-93. So Villa finished 2nd in that inaugural Premier League season. They're also one of only 5 English sides to win the European Cup, having won it in 1982. But really, in the 50s and 60s, a power block emerged in Liverpool and Manchester in the northwest, and you had Shankly and Busby creating dynasties. And that never really happened in Birmingham. And in latter years, ownership has been a real inhibiting factor for both clubs. Martin O'Neill seemed to be sending Villa in the right way, and then it spiralled after that. Now they've been relegated in the last few years, and Birmingham have been a yo-yo team for many years. So, I think the early stages of the creation of the Football League was the heyday for Aston Villa, and then they had some good years, like when they won the European Cup in 82. And he talks about consistently elite teams from London, but that's not really true, because until Abramovich took over Chelsea in 2003, Arsenal were the only London team challenging for titles, and that was only a relatively frequent basis. You forget how long English football has been dominated by either Manchester United, Liverpool, with kind of sprinkles of Arsenal, Nottingham Forest, Everton and other teams in there. That's just the way it is. Yeah. Ugank Jawali thinks Liverpool fans should be happy with a point and being 3 points clear despite being atrocious against West Ham. I would tend to agree with him on that one.
Talk more about that on the other podcast.
That's correct. Anurag Agarwal. This is one of my favourite emails we've got in a while. Hey guys, I was playing FIFA 19 Ultimate Team and I spotted an in-form Vitorino Hilton card released for this week. Now, I immediately recognised that name because Hilton was a mainstay centre-back for 2 non-PSG Ligue 1 winning teams, Marseille in 9-10 and Montpellier in 11-12. It turns out it's the same Brazilian lad who has stayed with Montpellier. So curiously, I checked his age, because it seemed odd for this sudden revival in form after a decade in his prime. He is 41 years old. Now, I did a bit of research. Mm-hmm. So, not having paid much attention to fifth place Montpellier this season, I looked it up. Hilton, at age 41, has played 20 out of 22 games this season. That's not even the best stat. According to CIES Football Observatory stats, Hilton has the 20th most minutes from January 1st, 2014 to the end of January 2019 in the top 5 leagues. The 20 most. He was 36 when they started tracking this.
Amazing.
From age 36, which in soccer terms is old for an outfield player, Hilton has 14,751 minutes, or 166 matches. That's more than Romelu Lukaku, who is 16 years younger. This is what Hilton said recently, Andrew. Do you want me to do in Champions League voice?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I forget that I'm 41. I think that helps me keep going. In Nantes, Nicolas Koza was celebrating his 20th birthday. I realised I was 21 years apart.
It's unbelievable.
The elder statesman. You know where his professional career started?
Chappaquince.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
How about that?
41, though. You think if
never,
you look at...
Never stop.
No.
We always say.
He says he feels good, and he's talking about renewing his contract, which is up at the end of this season.
We see this with keepers.
Yeah.
You don't... Outfield players.
Center back. Think of all the young whippersnappers he's chasing around the field.
Yeah.
He could be their dad.
No, I think it's great.
If he's marking Timothy Weah in League One, he could be his dad. Mm. Scott Siebel. He agrees with me on player motivation from last week's podcast, and he had a few other Liverpool questions, which we answered on that other podcast. Mm. John McAuliffe, what does Mark Hamsik's hair look like without gel in it? So when Mark Hamsik is hanging around his house at home in Naples, what does his hair look like? Like, look
maybe
at it.
Like a
look at it now
almost,
without
just
gel.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, it's probably just kind of...
floppy.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
We always answer the big questions on this podcast. Sean Rowden wants to know if we would do a Game of Thrones themed segment after your reference to the show last week. Your reference.
Maybe. It comes back. The final season comes back in a couple months, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm very excited.
Finally, Devin Byrne was, I think, one of the most classic misinterpretations of something we said on the podcast.
Oh, no.
I've been listening to the pod for about a year, and I've been meaning to submit an email for about a year. I always forget to send one during the long and treacherous 50-foot walk from my car to my apartment. Anyway, I'm about to head to the airport to catch a flight to Rome, and I'm hoping to see Roma versus AC Milan while I'm there. I don't have too much soccer analysis to pass along, but I do have a major bone to pick with you guys. A couple of months ago, you were discussing the apparently egregious act of purchasing matchday scarves with each team on either side, the date, the venue, etc. You know the half and halves we're talking about. I've been lucky enough to attend a Champions League match at the Camp Nou, Barca v Juve, and a Boxing Day match at Stamford Bridge, Chelsea-Brighton. I purchased matchday scarves at both events and have them hanging very proudly in my walk-in closet, the only area that my girlfriend will allow me to flaunt them. Sad sigh. Whenever I travel abroad, I typically bring back a scarf of the local club, and as someone who doesn't get too many high-profile games, I've wanted a way to commemorate the experience. I am a proud defender of the matchday scarf and all of us who have purchased one. Old Spursy Andy was really on his high horse that day. I will certainly be buying another one if they are available this weekend. I'll even pick one, an extra one up for you guys. Yay! In an attempt to sway your harsh opinions. They are decorative and functional. I am sure one of you could use a new scarf for your walk to the studio through the current polar vortex. Thank you very much, Devin. Devin, we don't like the half and half scarf when we see fans of one of the teams in the stadium holding them aloft, correct?
If you are a neutral fan...
That's fine.
Yes. I'm saying when Tottenham play Real Madrid in the Champions League, if I see a Spurs fan wearing that, I'm horrified by it.
Yeah, it's terrible. They are so tacky and awful. But if you want to commemorate that you were at that game, that's fine. And you see these terrible ones with, like, joined hands together, linking the two sides of the scarf.
Well, I get what they're trying to do there.
I know, but they're... It's
sportsmanship.
Pure, yeah, but it's tat.
Yeah. No, he misinterpreted. Now, look, having said all that, I still don't know if I love it, but a neutral fan that has it, who wants it as a keepsake from a match they attended, I'm okay with that.
Devin's flying around going to games. Yeah, you do you, bro.
He's been bad-mouthing me, I'm sure, for ever since we talked about this, and it's all been misinterpreted.
It's gone personal now.
Red card.
I'm going to go first here, if that's all right with you. My red card goes to PSG. The club is engaged in an ugly legal battle right now with their former midfielder, Hatem Ben Arfa, after he sued PSG for 8 million euros over his treatment at the club. Ordinarily, I would say that this just kind of sounds like a bitter player looking to get back at a club where he felt underappreciated, but there's more to it than that. In April of 2017, Ben Arfa scored twice for PSG in a French Cup semifinal. Not a bad showing. He then never played for them again. PSG shut him out over their next 70 matches, 15 months, until his contract ran out in June of last year. You remember this guy at Newcastle. Good player. I'm not saying he needs to start for PSG every week, but Ben Arfa's contract was heavily incentive-based, so he was therefore left with no possible way to recoup much of the money that he would have ordinarily received. I'm reading now from Goal.com. Ben Arfa's attorney, Jean-Jacques Bertrand, thinks the 31-year-old was effectively barred from playing for the club after team president Nasser Al-Khelaifi was angered by a comment the player made to the Emir of Qatar on a visit to Paris. Here's now quoting Ben Arfa's attorney. The explanation of this situation is that a few days after a match in April of 2017, the Qatari Emir and owner of the club came to a training session. At the end of it, all the players came to salute him, and Hatem, as any other player, came to the Emir and said, I'm happy to speak to you, because I sent a few messages to the president, and he didn't reply. It seems to me, this is the attorney again, saying that this is a pretty obvious thing to say, especially in a comical tone. No bad intentions, but apparently the team president didn't take it very well and froze him out for 70 matches. Now, obviously, Lionel Messi, Ben Arfa is not, but you cannot tell me that he's so bad that he shouldn't warrant a single appearance over a 15-month period. Remember, this all started after a game where he scored twice. And by the way, when he finally got a move to his current club, Rennes, he scored in his very first match. This sounds just like the ultimate in petty behavior from PSG team president. And maybe there's another side to the story.
But yeah, the other side to the story is that that's what happens when you have people who think they're elected by God to run a country and now think that they can extend the way that they rule that country to our football field in Europe. That's what that is. I'm not surprised by this. And I back Ben Arfa. I'll tell you who doesn't. Steve Bruce, because Ben Arfa was the very same guy who went missing and ran off to Paris. And Steve Bruce said, I don't know where he is.
So are you implying that Ben Arfa maybe has been forced to left reaping what he sowed?
No, because running away from Steve Bruce is reprehensible, but I have no time for the people who run PSG or any of these clubs. And
But maybe it'd be careful what you wish for situation with Ben Arfa. He ran off to PSG and look what he ran into.
Well, that's true.
Still not cool, though.
No, this is a terrible way to treat human beings.
Yeah. What do you have?
My red card is Nigel Pearson. I'm bringing you back to a day. Do you remember, Andrew?
We've played this before.
Yeah. Do you remember when Nigel Pearson saved Leicester from relegation in 14-15? Our podcast was but a boy of a year old. Mm-hmm. And I voted Esteban Cambiaso as my player of the year.
Yeah, he won your Devonling.
Yeah, as player of the year.
Because you're smarter than everyone.
Well, no, because he had Leicester up. And I was right, because keeping them up meant they would win the Premier League the following season.
Yeah, how'd they do without him the next year?
They won the Premier League.
So how important was he?
But they brought in a young buck from called Riyad Mahrez. That's not what I'm getting at here, by the way. Nigel Pearson has been sacked twice, effectively, by the owners of Leicester. Former Leicester City manager Nigel Pearson has been sacked as manager of Belgian second-tier side Louvain. Pearson leaves with the club bottom in their division, having managed just 22 points from 24 games. He had been in charge of Louvain since September 2017. King Power International owned both Louvain and Leicester City, who Pearson managed from 2011 to 2015 before he was sacked. So this is just to bring you back to that time when he was manager of Leicester and when he called a man, a journalist, an ostrich.
Unbelievable, the fact that you do not understand where I'm coming from. If you don't know the answers to that question, then I think you are an ostrich. Well, your head must be in the sand. Is your head in the sand? Are you flexible enough to get your head in the sand? My suspicion would be no. I can, you can't.
Any more questions? Should we wrap it up?
You can't. Positivity. Listen, you've been here often enough for you to ask that question. I think you're either being very, very silly or you're being absolutely stupid. One of the two.
What's Flemish or French or whatever language they speak in that area of Belgium for ostrich? That's what I
wanted.
Sounds
like he's ready to actually challenge him. He says, "Can you put your head in the sand? You can't. I can."
I love the way.
And then he pauses and says again, "I can."
Yeah.
Okay. What are you going to show us right now?
He decided that journalist was probably a little bit rotund. And Pearson, who has got a flat top haircut, looks like a sergeant major.
Yeah.
He's probably in great shape. So that was just a gratuitous reason to say that he's been sacked twice by the same company and to play the ostrich.
I always enjoyed that.
Caught Offside's Man of the Match.
My Man of the Match, Team of the Match, JJ, it's Newport County. The League Two side upset Middlesbrough in their fourth round FA Cup replay yesterday. 2-0 was the final. Nel Nal host Pep Guardiola and Manchester City in the fifth round of the FA Cup. In case you need reminding, Newport County folded in 1989 and then reformed. They were also 90 seconds away from being knocked out of the Football League altogether back in 2017. This is their first appearance in the fifth round of the Cup since 1949. Remember, they were in the fourth round of this tournament after having shocked Leicester City. And they only forced the replay with Burrow in this fourth round after scoring in the 93rd minute in the first match. Now they're going to receive more than £1 million. And we know how much that means to a club in this low of a tier. Robbie Wilmot scored the opener in the 47th minute. He was stacking shelves in a grocery store less than 2 years ago. Adding an extra layer of drama to this was the fact that Newport's keeper, Joe Day, missed their previous two matches because his wife was basically due to give birth to twins at any moment. Well, she hadn't, and he decided to take a chance and play in this game. Well, obviously, she went into labor during that game, and he found out at full time. He sprinted out of the stadium for the hospital. The manager said it's the fastest he's ever seen him run. Here's the stat that I leave you with as Newport prepare for this home fixture with Manchester City. Newport County are now unbeaten in their last five FA Cup fixtures against clubs from a higher division. Four wins and a draw. Pep, beware.
Hey, I can't believe you did a Newport rundown and you never mentioned the second goal. Have you seen the goals?
Yeah.
Pádraig Amon's goal was so good. And Pádraig Amon is the former Sligo Rovers player.
Oh, wow.
Player from County Carlow, I believe. And I've watched him play regularly in the showgrounds.
The thing about Newport County that makes them so dangerous to these clubs that come from the higher tiers of English football, I remember this when Tottenham played
there. It's their field.
It's JJ. It's a disaster.
Yeah.
Because it's the most played on pitch in England because they play on it. Another, I believe, Welsh league team plays on it, and a rugby league
Newport
team plays
Gwent
on
Dragons.
It. So I think it's been used something like over 60 or 70 times already this season.
I don't know.
I just enjoy this story because the whole narrative bothers me that people who say that the FA Cup, it's outlived its usefulness, whatever. And things like this always remind me to say to fans of the Premier League that say that to get over yourself, because the sport and this competition belongs to everyone, not just supporters of the high-profile clubs. So I like this, and I'll be rooting for them for sure when they face Manchester City.
Speaking of Manchester City, my man of the match is Vincent Kompany. This is from ITV. Manchester City captain Vincent Kompany says homelessness can be solved if society works collectively. The Belgian international explained that he felt compelled to help to set an example to his children and has launched the charity Tackle for Manchester. In 2017, the number of long-term homeless people rose by 41% to 500, showing that the problem is getting worse in the city Kompany has called home since 2008. And this is Vincent Kompany talking to ITV about this problem in Manchester.
As you can see, there's a lot of cranes going up, you know, left, right and centre. So it's a city that's progressing and developing. But at the same time, I don't think it's anyone's desire to leave anyone behind. And if we can at least have moments of solidarity and you know, let the community be, you know, what it's designed to be there for, then we have a chance to. I think it's an issue that can be solved. It's something that we can tackle face on, and you know, a bed every night is basically what it says, is making sure that we first of all deal with the issue of rough sleeping, and that we then perhaps deal with the whole issue of homelessness and the causes of it, really, to make sure it doesn't happen.
Now, I would argue that Vincent Kompany's employers could solve the homeless crisis in Manchester in a week, such as their wealth and money, but that's besides the point. I think Kompany comes across in the Amazon Manchester City documentary as somebody who was really taken to life in Manchester. I think when this period of Manchester City is over, of all the players, he will be the one most associated as a true blue, as a real Manchester City guy, as a real Mancunian. He's married, obviously, into a Manchester family, but the guy has taken the city to his heart. And a problem like this, something we see every day in New York City, and you do whatever you can, but it really spoke to me that he was doing this as well. It's fantastic.
I'm so consistently impressed with him.
Yeah.
Like, not just as a player, but like every time he speaks, I remember when he was on ESPN's commentary for the World Cup, I thought he was excellent. stuff like this is excellent. Remember, we talked about his father, Pierre Compagnie, who recently was elected as the first black mayor of a city in Belgium. The whole family, I'm just consistently impressed with. That's great stuff.
No, big fan of his.
Yep. So there you go, man. That is...
That's a meaty podcast.
One of two podcasts that we do have out this week. If you're looking, hey, where's all our Premier League stuff? I thought Man City played today. I thought they've jumped back over Liverpool. Why aren't they talking about that? There's another podcast out where we do, in fact, talk about all of that. But on this one, our thanks to John Strong. As always, love talking U.S. men with him. Check out the other podcast that we got for you. Hey, to you I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.